The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
Many people would say on a communion day they crossed the ferry, you know, on a confirmation day they crossed the ferry. It was a fantastic part of life.
As the Liffey Ferry comes out of retirement tomorrow morning, we look at the history and future of a service that dates back over 350 years. Also, the prison letters of Countess Markievicz. Author Lindy Nocton joins us to discuss what they reveal about her life, her views and her relationships. Plus...
There were three German houses that he was very interested in, and at various stages, members of the family tried to buy apples from them.
Family memories of Irish military intelligence and the important role of G2 during the Second World War. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. And we'll come back to those apples a little bit later in the programme, but intriguing. We begin this evening, though, with the common travel area. Over the last 2 years, the regulation of the movement of goods has dominated the Brexit negotiations. But the movement of people between Britain and Ireland could, of course, also prove complicated. Our reciprocal agreement of free movement rights includes the right to work, settle, claim benefits and even vote, and has lasted for the better part of 100 years. Partly, that's because our immigration policies have always been strongly aligned. But that could change now that Britain is leaving the EU and Ireland is staying put. This isn't the first time this unusual arrangement has hit a stumbling block. I'm joined by two guests who have been looking into the history of the Common Travel Area, our Open Borders Agreement with our nearest neighbour. Pearse McHenry is in our Cork studio. He's a lecturer in geography at University College Cork. And with me here in Dublin is Gavin Barrett, a professor of the Sutherland School of Law in University College Dublin. You're both very welcome indeed to the programme. Gavin, take us back to the Anglo-Irish Treaty. 1921, signed, sealed, not quite delivered in December of 1921, but finally delivered then in January of 1922. It doesn't say much about matters of migration and settlement. Was it assumed that reciprocal immigration and settlement would simply continue in the two jurisdictions?
To a certain extent, I think it was. Obviously, pre-1922, free movement had never been in question because it was the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland as such. So travel between Ireland and what's now Ireland and the UK was simply travel within the UK. But post-signature of the treaty, the issue of common travel actually didn't actually feature in the treaty, remarkably. But afterwards, UK officials realised the scale of the task that would have been confronting them in patrolling a 500-kilometre long border. So they made an offer to Irish officials that they would dispense with immigration controls, passports and visas, if you like, and so on and so forth, if Ireland enforced British immigration rules. And that was that arrangement, which was seized upon with alacrity by Irish officials who were anxious, as we know from letters of the time, to control aliens and, quote, keep Bolshevists at bay, was accepted with alacrity and confirmed in a letter February 1923.
I would imagine that the word immigration was almost not in the Irish lexicon back in the early 1920s.
No, that's very true, and to a certain extent I think this was an offer that was too good to refuse, because there would have been very, very little immigration into Ireland in Ireland at that time. So, making concessions in terms of enforcing British immigration rules, it was really hardly a concession at all.
Pearse, it's worn fairly well, despite the fact that there would have been a number of potential crises. One would have been the economic war in the 1930s, then neutrality in the 1940s, and I suppose finally the declaration of a republic 70 years ago in 1949. But it's worn well.
It's worn extraordinarily well, really, and in fact it's proved to be very resilient, perhaps partly in fact in due to the fact it's not actually embodied in a treaty, a formal international treaty. But certainly, I mean, you mentioned the Declaration of a Republic, and there were those on the British side who tended to feel after them, well, if the Irish want to be that independent, let them go off and we'll treat them as an entirely foreign country. But as it happens, pragmatic considerations overruled that on their side. They could see the benefits After all, the British economy was expanding then. The National Health Service had just come in. They were building their motorways. So it suited them very well to have this nearby source of English-speaking cheap labour on their doorstep, a culture that was familiar to them. And in a sense, it suited the Irish as well too. So we had the benefits of being an independent country, but managed to hold on to this privileged relationship with our former rulers. And it was, in a sense, the best of the both worlds for Ireland, as long as immigration did not loom large in our own internal policy considerations. And it didn't, as Gavin has already said, at that time.
Yeah, at that time, except now that 17% of the population of Ireland is immigrant. Who knows what's going to happen after the European Union, after the vacation of the European Union by Britain. But tell us a little bit more, Piarsh, about the hiccup during what we call the emergency, what they called apparently World War II.
Well, there was a concern at that point that there could be undesirables arriving into the United Kingdom via the back door of Northern Ireland. And it's very interesting that there are echoes of some current debates in that matter, because what they actually did was they introduced the necessity to have permits, but it was imposed between Northern Ireland and Great Britain, the very thing which they're now saying they can't do. And there's an interesting reply to a parliamentary question put in 1948 in the House of Commons, where the Undersecretary for the Home Office, in answer to a question from a Unionist MP, says, at one time, although I do not know if this was confirmed, the commander in Northern Ireland thought he could not have an effective control of the land border except with four divisions. Now, you know, one must make allowances for changes in technology and so on, but the point that was being made there really was that the border was more or less unsealable. And then these permits actually remained in place until 1952. And the reason for that was that the British wanted a very firm assurance that Irish immigration policy would continue to be aligned with British immigration policy. I would argue, in fact, that it really meant that we would effectively follow British immigration policy. And once those guarantees were in place from the Irish side, then the arrangement continued and the travel permit requirement was lifted.
And Gavin, do you reckon that the fact that this arrangement did survive World War II, it was indicative of the fact that it was quite robust?
Yes, there's no doubt it has been quite robust. I mean, it's been there since the foundation of the state. It survived the Irish-UK Economic War, World War II, the Declaration of a Republic, entry to the European Union, and the creation of the Schengen Zone. So it is durable, and I think probably its informality helped it to be durable, if you like, that what we ended up with from 1952 onwards was an administrative arrangement rather than a legally binding arrangement. And that actually suited both sides, because it didn't particularly suit, an Ireland, if you like, intoxicated to a certain extent upon nationalist rhetoric, if you like, to admit that it was allowing large numbers of its young people to go over and emigrate and work in Britain. And it suited as well the United Kingdom, the arrangement as well, because they were giving very favourable arrangements in terms of immigration to Irish citizens when they weren't willing to offer at times the same arrangements to Commonwealth citizens.
OK, we'll come back to 1952 and what actually happened in 1952 in just a few moments. But Piarsh, just to take you up on something you were talking about there earlier, and that was the fact that Northern Ireland travellers faced checks if they wished to enter Britain. This was something, obviously, that Unionists were not very pleased about, but of course they didn't have the balance of power at that stage. So did anybody care in Britain?
No, they took a pretty tough line, really. The Unionists raised it on a regular basis in the House of Commons, and of course they were unhappy with it, because clearly it stated what we know to be the case, that Northern Ireland was treated differently from the rest of the United Kingdom, which rather flew in the face of the normal kind of doctrine that Belfast is the same as Finchley. Was that what Mrs. Thatcher used to say? So in effect, it did mean it was being treated differently. But as I say, the British took the line that as long as they didn't have an absolute assurance that the Southern government was following the same immigration policies as themselves, they did have an ongoing concern with this leaky land border. And that's really the issue which still faces us today in certain respects.
Gavin, what happened then in 1952, and why did anything have to happen then?
Well, what happened was that from December 1946, Ireland permitted aliens to enter freely from Britain, and from the end of December 1947, the UK actually dropped its requirement of a permit when travelling between the island of Ireland and Great Britain, but they didn't drop immigration controls, and that, as Piarsh has mentioned, was something that very much annoyed Northern Unionists. So the UK government view was that they would only be prepared to abolish such controls if the Republic would once again join them in working a common system for the control of aliens and, to crucially, to follow a similar immigration policy, which, as Pirish correctly indicated, involved essentially us following UK immigration rules. So an administrative arrangement was then reached between Ireland and the United Kingdom. And the terms of that arrangement were quite interesting. The Irish authorities agreed to give the Home Office, for example, information about all aliens who entered or left Ireland, and it agreed to refuse leave to land to persons in transit to the UK if they hadn't permission to actually enter the United Kingdom, and indeed to readmit aliens who were refused access to the United Kingdom. So once Ireland was prepared to accept all of that, then essentially the arrangement went ahead. The British were happy to get rid of immigration controls. And it was interesting, you know, Irish officials were quite anxious. That it was never publicised, it was never made public. The terms of it were not made aware to either the Irish or English public at the time. And I think that its status as an administrative arrangement very much helped that and avoided giving it any embarrassing publicity. And interestingly enough, Frank Aiken, the Irish Minister for Foreign Affairs at the time, gave an astonishingly evasive reply to a Doyle question on whether there had been consultation on the abolition of controls. And instead of saying yes, that there had been, that there had been more than that in agreement, and then being forced to explain what the terms of it were, he simply said that the Irish government had been informed, but that its attitude was that the abolition of a British control was a matter for the British themselves.
And could I just add to that, absolutely succinct point there made by Gavin, a dramatic example of that in a sense is that as recently as the 1980s, when I was myself a civil servant in a different government department, the Home Office used to circulate a famous, we called it the Black Book, which was actually the monthly updated index of persons forbidden entry to the UK. It was issued by the British authorities, but that was circulated to all Irish embassies and missions. And if a person on that list applied to come to Ireland, without even indication they intended to visit the UK as well, the automatic practice was to refuse them. So we simply followed the British line without any question. And the other point I would like to make is that in terms of the difference between administrative and legislative arrangements, I think it's been a long-standing tradition in the Department of Justice that they have preferred to operate by administrative fiat rather than legislation, because that means they're less likely to be held up to questioning via the process of the old questions and so on. It has suited the minister of the day to have a wide degree of discretion in immigration matters generally, and that remains the case in certain respects today.
And Pirish, then, in the 70s and 80s, during the troubles with the passage of amendments, with the passage of various Prevention of Terrorism Acts amendments to that legislation or whatever, how did that affect the common travel area?
Well, you just mentioned something there which I think, and again I defer to Gavin on this one, but the PTA does represent in effect a challenge to the CTA, because it did give the power for people to be prevented from entering, not only coming from Northern Ireland through Britain, but also they could be prevented from coming from the Republic to any part of the United Kingdom. So the PTA in effect transcended the normal provisions of the CTA, and there are some questions to be asked there about the extent to which that might be in certain situations used or abused to get around the normal terms and conditions of the CTA. But I think Gavin would have a more precise answer on that one.
Gavin?
Well, actually, just 2 points on what Pirish has had to say there. The point about informality, I think, is a very telling one indeed. And that is that, you know, there's been a constant preference in the history of the common travel area for administrative cooperation over laws. When it came to laws, statutory instruments over statutes, and obscure statutes over clear ones, with the result that you had as much secrecy and flexibility as possible in the organisation of this. And of course, Pirish is absolutely right concerning the PTA, and that emphasises another point actually about the common travel area, and that is its fragility in a number of respects, both to legislation and to other aspects as well. So for instance, one point that we've all experienced in recent times is that when you travel from the United Kingdom to Ireland through Dublin Airport, you are asked for your passport. I travelled back the other day from Newcastle Airport myself, my passport was demanded of me. There are, at the same time, you can travel north and south of the border, you can travel on the ferries very frequently without producing your passport, but it is a fragile construct indeed, and it is vulnerable to legislative interventions and indeed interventions by private parties like Ryanair, for instance.
Do we need to distinguish between the right of travel and, say, the right of residency and the right to benefits and the right to vote?
Well, nobody is questioning those. And in fact, you know, it has been one of the great success stories that there's an extraordinary degree of reciprocity and rights accorded to the Irish in Britain and the British in Ireland. They too can vote, of course, in Irish elections, with the exception of the presidential election, because they don't have the equivalent over there. It's based very much on the idea of reciprocity.
So if we could elect the Queen, we would be entitled to a vote on the monarchical election in Britain, yeah? Gavin, the entry then into the European Union, or the EEC as it was then in 1973, the Schengen Common Travel Area, did that exist before we both joined on the 1st of January 1973? Did that come later? And how did that affect, or might that have affected the Common Travel Area?
Well, our entry into the European Union had a number of effects. One of them was that it involved us, I suppose, three different effects. One of the initial entry was a point, and then I suppose the Schengen agreement was another crucial element then, and the single market in between the two of them. So if I can just deal with those three elements. The first of them, actually, the entry into the European communities in 1973, meant that as part and parcel of that, we entered a customs union with all of the other member states. And in actual fact, that put an end then to the requirement of customs controls to control tariffs, taxes between the countries, but it didn't put an end to them to control other aspects like agricultural checks or plant health checks or consumer protection or that kind of thing. That remained until, if you like, the second step, which was the coming into force of the single European market at the beginning of 1993. From that point onwards, customs controls could be done away with. And there are actually three sets of controls that have been possible, if you like, along the border with Northern Ireland. Customs controls, security controls, British Army checkpoints, if you like, and Garda checkpoints and so on and so forth, and then passport controls. We never had passport controls because of the common travel area. We had customs controls until 1993. Then, if you like, the single European market sweeps them away. And then the security controls could finally be done away with then as a result of the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. Now, as regards the Schengen area, which was, of course, the border-busting agreement that the other member states agreed to, you know, that was always, I suppose, envisaged, if you like, by European Union, but it was something that couldn't happen, ironically, within the European Union, because the British opposed it so resolutely. So what happened was you had an intergovernmental treaty agreed between other states in 1985, then again in 1990, and it entered into force in 1995. And that was integrated into the European Union treaties with the coming into force of the Treaty of Amsterdam in 1999. But the British didn't want it. And it's a logical impossibility, if you think about it, to be part of two common travel areas at the same time, unless the entire membership of each common travel area is prepared to allow all members of the other common travel area into their common travel area. The British are saying they simply didn't want to be in a common travel area with the other European states. So Ireland then had a choice. Do we join Schengen or do we stay in the common travel area with the United Kingdom? And a reputed 70% of all of the traffic leaving Ireland was either going to the United Kingdom or going through the United Kingdom at the time. So really, from a practical point of view, the practical arguments militated strongly in favour of remaining within the common travel area. And so as a result of that, a kind of PS to the treaty, a protocol to the treaty. In fact, three of them were actually negotiated facilitating that and basically allowing Ireland to continue on with the common travel area with Britain. And incidentally, that was actually the first treaty reference ever made to the common travel area, remarkably. And it's not actually in a treaty between Ireland and the UK at all, but a European Union treaty. Mm. So that was made. That facilitated it, if you like, the continuation of the common travel area. Ireland actually was reluctant. The British entered into that because they wanted to maintain border controls. We simply entered into that arrangement because we wanted to maintain the common travel area. And we actually attached a declaration at Amsterdam indicating that we'd enter into anything, if you like, any free movement measures that were compatible with maintaining the common travel area. But I'm afraid we weren't as good as our word in that regard. And we've taken advantage, if you like, of the arrangements, our opt-out with an opt-in, if you like, concerning Schengen, we've taken advantage of that just to opt into what we want to. And it has taken on a bit of a life of its own, so that when the British expanded that protocol with the Treaty of Lisbon in 2007 to justice and home affairs cooperation generally, we actually went with them, so that our opt-out, merely out of free movement, things became a much bigger opt-out.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, Gavin Barrett and Piarsaigh McHenry, for joining us and talking to us about the history of the common travel area and some of the complexities perhaps that might arise from Britain's exit from the European Union. Now, as you may have heard, the Liffey Ferry is going to set sail again after a 35-year absence from the river. Starting tomorrow at 7 a.m, the water taxi will carry workers, tourists and anyone who wants to get a different perspective on the city from quay to quay for €2 a trip. The ferry has a long history, stretching back over 350 years. The service was discontinued in the 1980s with the opening of the Eastlink Bridge. But now, one of the original boats, the No. 11 ferry, is coming out of retirement. Earlier, our producer, Lorcan Clancy, went to Dublin's Docklands to find out more.
I spent the first 10 years of my life in Whelan House. That's the apartments beside the church, overlooking the River Dodder.
Richie Saunders is a former skipper with the Liffey Ferry Service, just one of the jobs he held in a long maritime career. He was born and bred in Ringsend.
As I was growing up, I was looking out of the Dodder. There was a few boats in the Dodder then, and in the Grand Canal, I used to give the lock keepers a hand when we were children, opening the gates. The ships are going in and out every day, and I was looking at the ships going in, so I'd imagine I got me urge to go to sea by looking at ships every day.
The ferry service was decommissioned in 1984. One of the original boats, No. 11, was eventually bought by Richie, who decided to repair and preserve it.
So we've got the ferry about 2010. My son's a metal fabricator, Barry. Had a word with Barry, brought him over and seen the boat. It was in a bad way, and you're talking about a lot of work, and asked him, would he do it with me? And he says, yes, Dad, I would. But he was sorry later because it took 4 years.
After further restoration, No. 11 has now been relaunched as a working ferry.
Myself and Richie go back a long time, and I was in love with the boats, and I wanted to see, just like Richie, it back on the water. It was part of our history, and I had a great vision for it to be part of the future for the next generation.
Jimmy Murray of the Irish Nautical Trust is also from Ringsend. The Trust is operating a training programme to provide young people with practical marine experience.
We have a need for the skills that kept beside Dublin Port and the maritime industry, and this is a skill set that was passed down by the fathers, and it's a skill that's needed in the future. The funding that's made from the ferry will go to contribute to all those courses that they need to play. Although it's providing a service back to the people of Dublin, it is a training vessel, and the profits from that will go to help those young people move forward with that industry.
You can trace the roots of the ferry service back to 1665, when it was established by a royal charter signed by King Charles II.
It really started when the city was developing. They had to cross the river at some stage. So the first bridge would have been the first priority. But before that started, there was a boat to bring them back and forward. So as the city grew, they'd build another bridge further down, and the ferry, it actually started way up an island bridge. As the city progressed, the bridges came down and the ferry moved down.
Going back like 1600s, there would have been rowing boats that ferried across. There would have been rowing ferries. So it moved all the way down, and that's the way the city has graduated down into the port. I mean, it was primarily for dockers, but I mean, you had people went to school, people went over to see their girlfriends, their aunts and uncles. I used to travel off the Sheriff Street to see my Aunt Rosie. Many people would say on a communion day they crossed the ferry, you know, on a confirmation day they crossed the ferry. It was a fantastic part of life, and it was the connection between two communities, you know what I mean?
I'm welcomed on board the ferry by one of the new skippers, Thomas Murray.
How are you, Lorcan? There's your ticket for the fair today.
Oh, thanks very much, Thomas. What's this?
This is a reprint of, it's a commemorational ticket just for the opening of the ferry back. We'll be here 7 in the morning every morning. We have to hold on to the heritage, so I'm the next generation now being passed to, like, you know, getting the training of youths back onto the river and into maritime in the city, like, you know.
The ferry seats 18 passengers and 2 crew. There'll be 3 stops on the route, MV Killarna at Northwall Quay, Sir John Rogerson's Quay on the south side, and 3 Arena on the north side.
Yeah, we'll be starting tomorrow, 7 a.m. Cold, windy, doesn't matter, she's gone. You'll have members of the public and tourists jumping on board just to have a cross, you know, cross the Liffey in a jiffy. You know what I mean? So they really enjoy the crack. They might have asked loads of questions, and the questions will be answered because everybody that'll be driving the boat will have great history, you know what I mean, to answer all the questions.
I mean, we're good talkers. We talk all they want, you know.
It's a very different Dublin, this new ferry is serving.
Oh, that's completely different. When the everything went into decline, the docks died, and there was little cattle yards here and old dirty industry. Now we're looking at brand new office blocks, restaurants. There's more coming, you know. And it's nice, even in the boat now, it's actually pleasant to be in the middle of the river looking at the view, you know.
And Lorcan Clancy was reporting there from the River Liffey on the history and the future, thankfully, of the Liffey Ferry. After the break, we'll be looking at the prison letters of Countess Markievicz.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Markievicz, Prison Letters and Rebel Writings is a new book which collects the correspondence of the Countess herself. They reveal her character, her day-to-day life behind bars, her opinions on events in Ireland and her relationship with friends and family. The letters were compiled and edited by Lindy Nocton, and she joins me now in studio. Lindy, you're very, very welcome.
Thank
indeed.
You.
This is not your first essay into the life and times of Countess Markievicz, is it?
No, it's because when I was writing the biography, I realised that the copy of the letters that had been, the published version of the letters that had come out in the 1930s, varied an awful lot from what I was reading in the National Library. And a lot of it was kind of because some people were still alive at the time, such as Maud Gonne. And so it was like trying to fill the holes in a jigsaw puzzle, in fact, you know, trying to figure out. And I'm not saying I got it perfect. I am not saying I got it. If anyone, I hope people will come up with their opinions on what I've done as well. And I'm very happy to hear from them if they do.
One thing that strikes you reading the contents page of your book is how much time she spent in and out of prison between 1916 and 1923.
She did. It's something that we were inclined to forget. And she died, as we know, she wasn't even 60. But she spent the bones of 3 years in jail. And in the first jail in particular in Aylesbury, it was, as she says, with the gutter rats of the world, though she only said that in an unofficial letter. Most of her letters were quite official, so she didn't lambaste the condition she was in, because her whole view was, I'll just keep my head down, keep quiet, you know. But the food was terrible. The sanitary conditions were disgusting. The beds were hard. There was rats everywhere, the usual sort of thing. She was in prison with, as she says, prostitutes. But her, Constance being Constance, she did see the human side of it and realised that something had to be done about these women. And she wasn't unsympathetic to their lives or their cause.
She also spent some time in what's probably one of the most famous women's prisons in the world, Holloway.
Well, she was in Holloway when she was elected as the MP. And she was more of, that period was as a political prisoner, and she was with Maud Gonne and Kathleen Clark, and okay, they were bored out of their minds, but she painted, she made little embroideries and things. She made the most of her time there. I think Aylesbury was the real shocker. Holloway, they ended up in a hospital wing, so they were well enough looked after. They Kathleen Clark in particular protested, she became quite ill, so they had to have a better diet. So, but I still feel that it's hard for us to realise or to imagine what effect on your health 3 years of a really poor diet and being bored out of your trolley and being incarcerated is like.
She was also in jail for a short period of time, jailed by her own side, in a way, as it were, during the Civil War.
She was indeed, down in Cork. Which she says that was her best period. Everywhere she went, by the way, she made gardens. She was a great gardener.
She could do a folder's guide to prisons. I mean, she was Aylesbury, Holloway, Cork, Mountjoy. She was everywhere.
Well, she said that. She said, Cork is my favourite jail.
Right,
that was the best one.
I was going to ask you, did she have a particular favourite? What kind of things does she talk about in the letters? Is she
Is she official or is she chatty? And does it depend on who she's writing to? How did she come across?
I found, to her sister, you can tell she's discussing the politics of the time. She's extremely interested in all the gossip, interestingly enough. So they got in Holloway, they got newspapers in. So she was very interested in what was going on in the world outside. She had to avoid politics a lot of the time because, as she said, she found it hard because, as she says, all of life is politics. So how can they say I don't write about politics? But she also, in her early letters, she's given instructions to both her sister and her brother of what to do with her property and so on. But you can tell in the Aylesbury letters in particular how bored she was because she talks about her dreams. Talks about art. I mean, things got better as she got an art magazine in and she got paints in and things like that. But she discusses everything. I mean, they're very chatty, and there's a few there that even when I read them now, they would bring a tear to your eye, really, that she was towards the end, you know, that she was... She had a hard life and she was very sympathetic to people, and you could tell how much she was trying not to upset her family as well.
Now, she writes, amongst others, to Kathleen Clark, but I know that Kathleen Clark writing to other people wasn't necessarily particularly generous towards Countess Markievicz, having listened to Ruth Dudley Edwards talking about the Countess and what Kathleen Clark thought of her, described her as madam, and felt that she looked down on the other prisoners?
No, I don't think that's fair at all. I actually don't agree with it. She lived with Kathleen Clark after prison for a time. And as Kathleen Clark says in the biography, the excellent biography written by her great niece, or is it just her niece, Helen Lytton, I've forgotten your surname. But there's a very nice biography of Kathleen Clark, and you realise they were just very different and they had squabbles, and the squabbles are quite fascinating, really, because they, on one occasion, Kathleen said to her, "Would you get out of this cell?" This was in Holloway. "You're smoking, you're annoying me, I hate the smell of the paint, just go away." And she said, Con was sitting outside her door going, "Oh, Kathleen, let me in. And she'd say, no, you can't come in. And then in the end, she said, "I just caved in." She was a good soul at heart.
Does she write about her appointment as cabinet minister? She was in jail, as you say, during that period in Holloway.
I find that interesting because she was in Holloway. She wasn't a minister, obviously, when she was in jail. That happened when she came out because she was there for the second meeting of the Dáil. She was out for that. And then at that point, De Valera made her minister for Labour.
Yeah, because there were only four cabinet ministers appointed in the first Dáil, and then four more appointed at the meeting of the second Dáil. Yeah.
But I think, and people can argue with me about this, that at the time, what we don't realise is Labour politics was only in its infancy. Connolly had died. There was nobody else at the time who was still alive who had an interest in Labour matters and the plight of the working man. And she was made minister, but as you know, her role as minister was taken out of the cabinet very soon, not because she was a woman, but because they really didn't care about working class politics. But no, she doesn't write much about it because that would have been the stretch where she was on the run, and she'd be extraordinarily careful about what she wrote.
A lot of the letters in the book, and a lot of them are signed off. This is to Eva, to her sister. They're signed off the Chara Igúis na hÉireann, your friend in the cause of Ireland. So she's writing to a family member. Does she write about other family members? Does she write about Casimir, the husband? Does she write about her daughter? She has been accused of abandoning her daughter, which may be a little bit extreme.
It is a bit extreme. I mean, she does write about them far more than I had noticed in the original copies of the original published copies of the letters. She's clearly concerned about her daughter, but her daughter, like a lot of children of parents who led erratic lives, was sent to live with her granny. And it was felt that that was the best thing. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that kind of happening with some friends. You know, the granny is lonely, so you'd send off one of your kids.
Is there an element of the aristocrat about it as well? Because the children of aristocrats were frequently dispatched elsewhere, whether it's to boarding school or what have you.
I think we have to beware, as you know, of judging previous periods of history by the standards of our time. I mean, my mother in Second World War was packed off to her uncle down in this was in Scotland, and there was nothing thought about it at the time. But yes, she, you can tell though that she had a very good relationship with her stepson Staskow, although he clearly drove her mad because he was clearly a waste of space. Sorry, but you could tell that he wasn't the most reliable of human beings. But she was. You can tell in the letters that she's, and this once again, when people cast aspersions on her relationship with her husband, she was terrified of getting them into trouble, so she couldn't mention them and she couldn't talk about them. What was going on was that they communicated with Eva, and Eva would tell her in person, but nothing was written down. So it's not black and white.
The letters were, as you say, originally published in 1932, but very different to the letters that you have chosen here. This was in a response, I think, to a Seán Ó Fualán biography, was it?
Yeah, that Esther Roper, who was the companion of Eva Gore Booth, and Con's friends, were very annoyed about Seán Ó Fualán's biography. They felt that it emphasised, it was more about Casimir than about her. Personally, I like his biography. I don't see anything wrong with it. But then that's speaking from this perspective. I like the way Seán Ó Fualán writes anyway. But that was the reason they were written. And Esther Roper's introduction to the original letters is very nice. I like it. It's a good piece of work.
But you have a different take on the letters and a different selection of the letters yourself.
Well, I decided to put in, I went through the letters and I reinserted lots of stuff that had been left out, and spent hours, you know, on the cover there's this huge blot. There was a lot of blots. And also, if people can go into the National Library Manuscripts department, and it's worth seeing them, you know, that the censor would cut out huge, it was just cut. And there you are wondering what on earth did she say there. But I also included letters to her brother in particular, to her mother, a few others to just show what the family thought of her, just to try and broaden out the perspective on her. But I think her brother is also slightly underestimated because he was one of the pioneers of the cooperative movement in Ireland. He wasn't a bad man at all, and he had to put up with her. You know, he kept her alive, you know.
Okay, the book is called Markievicz Prison Letters and Rebel Writings, edited by Lindy Nocton, published by Merrion Press. Thank you very much for joining us on the History Show to talk about the letters and what they reveal about her life and relationships. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be hearing about Irish military intelligence during the Second World War.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
51551 for your text, and we're going to turn now to the subject of Irish military intelligence during World War II. Ireland, of course, was officially neutral during the war, or the emergency as it was known here, but it wasn't as straightforward as all that. The Directorate of Military Intelligence, also known as G2, broke codes, intercepted German naval and aerial communications, and shared information with the Allies, neutral, schmutral. The people who took part in these efforts were, for a long time, mostly unnamed and unhonoured. We're going to hear now the story of one of these individuals in this report from Mark McMenamin.
Mind your head up here. The lone wolf.
This is Luke Smith. I'm in his attic at his house in Cabinteely, and he's showing me a very special family possession.
This is our prized possession from the attic in Belton Park. In fact, it spent its entire life in the attic in Belton Park. It's a radio.
Luke's father, Luke Sr., was a member of G2, the intelligence branch of the Irish Defence Forces.
My father was Luke P. Smith and was a servant all his life to Ireland. When my father went up to the attic, nobody was allowed there.
Luke's father's radio was no ordinary radio. He told his children he was listening to football matches in England. But in reality, he was listening in to illegal German radio traffic during World War II.
I wouldn't even know how to connect it up to make it work. But he spent lots of time up there listening to football matches on the radio. Now, of course, we know that, in fact, what he was doing was intercepting calls on it. More than likely, checking out German traffic within Dublin. He was an amazingly quiet man, insignificant. You wouldn't notice him anywhere, not loud in any way. He faded into the background. He was always the quiet man.
there were some quirks I remember from my own days in Belton Park as a kid growing up, that he had this annoying habit of having his dinner or his tea in those days. It wasn't his dinner. Everybody had their dinner in the middle of the day. But he had his tea when he came home from work, and he'd have the Evening Herald. And all of a sudden, he'd fold up the paper and say, sorry, Molly, I have to go to Eason's. And she said, OK, and that'd be it. There was never any. Now, the number of times I heard that quote, sorry, Molly, I have to go to Eason's.
Luke's work with G2 was subject to the Official Secrets Act, but he had a novel way of slipping out of the home to go to work.
Eason's had nothing to do with anything. It was obviously a code between Luke and Molly, and it meant something has come up, I must go, so he was going to Eason's.
On more than one occasion, Luke's father brought him along to help him monitor some of the German spying operations in Ireland during the war.
I was dispatched in to see if they'd any apples for sale, and always got the door slammed in me, and out I had to go, but a big iron gate on it anyway out. And I said, I don't think they've any apples, because they're spying the door on me, and my father would toddle on. There were three German houses that he was very interested in, and at various stages, members of the family tried to buy apples from them. We didn't think very much. We knew very much about it at that time, but it's only in retrospect that, of course, with the war on, that he obviously had an interest in that.
Luke Smith worked closely with Dr. Richard Hayes, the Irish state cryptographer during World War II.
He was very, very close to Richard Hayes, but the one that we knew best of all was Dan Brown, who was a regular visitor to our house.
Speaking in the 1980s, Colonel Dan Brown, the former director of Irish military intelligence, outlined just how severe the German threat of invasion was.
In 1939 and 40, they were thinking in terms of a submarine war. But they were thinking in terms of the submarine war of 1917 and early 1918, which was fought out off the south of Ireland. And the big development that, of course, came in the Second War was the invention of ASDIC, and, or what the Americans called sonar, which gave a great jump forward in the detection of submarines.
Luke Smith worked quietly in the shadows for G2, and as a result of his work and those like him, all German spies active in Ireland during the war were all eventually captured.
He was a mysterious man. He was a fabulous, quiet man and a brilliant father to his family.
Luke P. Smith died on January 25th, 1977, aged 75 years. He was still on active service with G2 on the day that he died.
The story there of Luke P. Smith, who worked during the Second World War for G2, the Directorate of Military Intelligence, and he was remembered there by his son and his namesake, Luke Smith. That report was by Mark McManaman, who joins me now in studio. Mark, you're very, very welcome indeed. You've written the recently published book Codebreaker, which looks at, in detail, G2, at German spies in Ireland, the people like Goertz and people like that, and also Richard Hayes and his efforts to break Nazi ciphers. Tell us a little bit more, though, about Luke Smith. Would he? What was the day job?
Well, thanks very much for having me, Miles. And indeed, what you said earlier, neutral schmutral, in my opinion, as well.
Oh, yeah.
Luke Smith is an incredibly interesting man. He worked in the National Library, much like Richard Hayes.
So Hayes was his boss, basically.
Yeah, they would have worked together. And, Luke was he was a library assistant. He would have started out there. But Luke Smith would have learned his intelligence work, much like a lot of the guys in G2, with Michael Collins and the intelligence section of the old IRA. And indeed, Collins taught very highly of Smith, and there's even a picture of the two of them together, and he's following him closely behind. So he would have learned his intelligence gathering techniques in that regard. And of course, then with the outbreak of the war, he's moved full time into G2, and it becomes much more of a, he becomes much more of an asset in terms of intelligence gathering, as you could hear there in the report.
Tell me more about the apples, the story of the apples, because it is a fascinating story.
Yeah, and this was quite interesting because Luke was telling me this when I interviewed him, and I found it incredibly interesting indeed. There were a number of German safe houses in the IRA safe houses, I suppose, and German spies that would have been staying in these. People like Wilhelm Preetz, who would have been one German spy, Werner Unland, and of course the more famous German spies like Hermann Goertz and Günther Schultz. And this one house in particular was on the north side. It was in Drumcondra. And Luke P. Smith, Luke Smith Jr.'s father, had a novel way, I suppose, of trying to gain some information on who was staying in this particular house. He sends Luke up to knock on the door and ask, have they any apples for sale? And, of course, the bemused German says, there's no apples for sale here. But just a little bit down the road, there's Luke Sr. with his notepad taking down the various particulars and details and the physical appearance of the man who answered the door. So this is one of the many novel ways they have of gathering intelligence and seeing who's who on the streets in Dublin.
Speaking of novels, you're reminding me of Joe Joyce's novel, terrific novel, Echolab, which deals with all of this period. What kind of radio traffic would Smith have been monitoring in those days? I mean, it wasn't voice messages, was it?
No. These are messages that were broadcast in Morse code, okay? German spies had a number of different ways of communicating messages in Ireland back out to the German High Command. Some of these would have been, you know, I suppose, handwritten, encoded and enciphered and sent out through the post. Of course, G2 would have had postal sensors, you know, trying to catch this stuff and forward it onto G2. But where Luke P. Smith comes into the picture, and many others in Army military intelligence, such as Captain John Patrick O'Sullivan, they are listening in on listening stations, okay? They're listening in and they're trying to listen into the broadcasting frequency that the messages are being transmitted via Morse code out in. They're taking them down in numerical sequence and they're brought then into the cryptography units in G2 or in Irish military intelligence, which is located in a building called the Red House on Montpellier Hill. It's actually still there today. It's a derelict building opposite the Criminal Courts of Justice. It's a listed building as far as I'm aware, but they're brought in there to be decoded by members of G2 and of course then Dr. Richard Hayes, who is unofficially, I suppose, the state cryptographer during this period. He's Ireland's one-man Bletchley Park.
Yeah, and not afraid to share information and to share intelligence with his friends across the water.
No, and that's the key thing about people like Richard Hayes, Luke Smith, Dan Bryan, all these guys, and in my opinion, are very, very much great patriots because they could see the woods from the trees. They could see that it was important to share this information with the British, with the Allies, and not to be kind of, I suppose, narrowed down by a sense of nationalism, because they could see that the Ireland was very vulnerable on two fronts, from a German invasion, but also a preemptive Allied invasion if the Germans were to gain a foothold here. So it was very important to share this information with the Allies. And of course, you know, it ensured that the right side won in the end.
And Hayes wasn't just a formidable code breaker, he was a formidable people breaker as well. He was an interrogator.
Yeah, he was an interrogator, and not in the style that you would think. You know, you think that it's almost in terms of, as you say, people breaking, but Hayes formed a great relationship with Hermann Goertz and really brought him on side, and it was then that he was able to outsmart him and break his communication code. Now, the Goertz cipher is very important in historical terms because, as we know, it's an ISOS cipher, which there's an entire section of Bletchley Park dedicated to trying to break. And Bletchley Park are having difficulty with this. When Hayes finally breaks the cipher, they send over staff over to Ireland, over to Dublin during the war to see how this encryption method can be broken. And it's hugely important to the war.
I think what you're basically telling us is why we weren't invaded during the Second World War. Mark McMillan, thanks very much for joining us on the History Show
this evening.
And the book is called Codebreaker. I would highly recommend it, published by Gill. That's all we've got time for this evening's programme. Details of all our items as well as podcasts are available on our website, rte.ie/history. My thanks tonight to Damien Chanel on sound and our researcher Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. From me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.